As I said already, this morning we were reminded that created beings of the unseen spiritual world, subject to God's sovereign permissive will, and I want to emphasize that, God is in control of all things, both the unseen and the seen world. Subject to God's sovereign will, these unseen spiritual beings can intrude into our world for good and for ill. And we meet that from time to time in the Bible, and we certainly saw that this morning in our study in 1 Samuel. But our focus this evening is not on this aspect of the natural. We're not going to think about, are ghosts real? Graham actually touched on that this morning. How does the supernatural, in the sense of spiritual beings, manifest itself? What is to be our expectation? But rather on how God manifests his power in our world today. So to pose some questions, in what ways do we experience God's supernatural power? Because God's power, of course, always is supernatural power, because he's supernatural. He is the supreme one. He is the eternal God. Should we expect miracles like those we encounter in the Gospels, in Jesus' ministry while here on earth? Do we expect those to be the ongoing pattern for the church? Or were such miracles confined to the days of Jesus and his apostles? Well, such questions, I'm sure this is no surprise to you, have divided Christians for centuries and remain a very hot topic in our day. I've, in preparation for this, although I'm not particularly going to focus on it, as a background to my reading, have reread quite a lot of material on the history of miracles since the days of Jesus. And it's quite a story. We're not going to get lost in that story this evening. But one thing's for sure in reading, it's always divided the people of God. At one extreme, we have what are termed the cessationists. So take the word cease, stop, and then you get the word cessationists, who believe that the miracles accompanying Jesus' earthly ministry, along with the New Testament charismatic gifts, ceased when the apostolic period, that is, the apostles that Jesus appointed, came to an end. So that's one extreme. At the other extreme, we have the so-called continuationists. That's a big word, isn't it? We're from the word continue. That's very obvious, really. Who believe that the miracles, particularly physical healing, and even at the extreme end, the raising of the dead, along with charismatic gifts, should be the normal experience of the church, of the healthy church. And then in between, we have those who are non-cessationists, who would not go, or wouldn't be able to go as far as saying what the cessationists say, but cannot align themselves with the continuationists. So they're termed here the non-cessationist. And perhaps as a leadership, perhaps as a church, what we would be characterized by, if we can be characterized by one sense, is the third one. But we intend, as you see in the next point here, to tackle this matter in detail during our planned study of 1 Corinthians later this year. Now, I think Graham's here. We anticipate hitting that part of 1 Corinthians around the autumn, don't we? At least this year sometime. And of course, chapters 12 through 14, for those that are familiar with that letter, face us with the heart of this issue of charismatic gifts. So we'll tackle that later this year. This evening I want to focus on the question which is related, really. Is one of the key reasons for seeking what we might call the spectacular in our Christian experience, miracles, is one of the reasons for that, is the key reason for that, our lack of understanding of what we call the natural? So that's where we're going to go. We're going to focus on the natural. So I'm sorry if that disappoints you in your expectation this evening. I hope you leave less disappointed if you are. But first I want to share a little of my personal testimony. Some of you, I think quite a few of you, have heard me give my testimony in the past. What I want to focus on, and you'll see why when I share what I share, my conversion is rather a strange conversion. That's not just because I'm strange, although if you know me, of course, I've got a slightly strange part about me. Talk to Marion. But basically, because God dealt with me in a rather different way than he often deals with people in bringing them to faith. So my story, without going into great detail, because we don't have a lot of time, but I want to get to the crisis part of it. I didn't grow up in a Christian home. I certainly, with a scientific background, had strongly embraced through my latter time at school and then at university. I was solid, swallowed, and promoted the by-chance origins of the universe and evolutionary theory. I was a strong defender of that, and Marion had to experience that when we first met, and yet she was a Christian, but of course I was lobbying, but also wanting to win the lady, so a little bit cooperative. But all of that journey brought us to this place here, actually, looked a bit different, but this place, and through God's, which I now know to be God's providence, in lots and lots of intricate ways, I found myself regularly coming along listening to the morning preaching. And I have to tell you, I hated it. I didn't hate it because I hated the person that was saying it, but it just didn't actually fit with my worldview. So there were lots of discussions, and it was over a relatively short period of time, about 5 months, I suppose, from around the summer when my son was born, Matthew. You can see how long ago it is because he's now in his second half of his 30s. Yes, thank you, Marion. And just that following Christmas. And it came to a head, and that's why I want to get to straight away. So it came to a head when I heard a sermon on Psalm 19. Anybody know how Psalm 19 begins? The skies proclaim the work of his hands. Day after day, they utter forth speech. Night after night, they proclaim knowledge. There is no place or language where this voice is not heard. Now this, of course, when it's properly expounded, isn't going to sit well with a dyed-in-the-wool evolutionist. So I was pretty mad at the end of the sermon, and again, you've heard this before, and you know, I was 25, reasonably well and fit, unlike now, and I was pretty upset with the preacher, found myself out the back, which is here at that point in time, before anybody else, so I could collar him, and I literally did, picked him up, dragged him into a little room on the side here, and I didn't assault him, I didn't beat him up, so don't worry, that's not my character, but I was pretty mad, and I said to him that if he couldn't possibly, this is pretty arrogant, isn't it, you couldn't possibly have believed what you said in your sermon this morning. That is intellectually impossible. If you think I'm going to put my brains in a liquidizer to become a Christian, then this is the last time we meet. I'm out of here. And those are pretty much the words I used. So we better meet. So we arranged to meet. He got a problem with his eyes. He got conjunctivitis and couldn't show up. And that was a Wednesday. On the Friday evening, I went to bed, and something happened. Now, I had been reading lots of stuff that he was giving to me. So, you know, what book would you give to somebody who isn't very sympathetic but can't stop coming along? Well, he gave me Dr. Martin Lloyd-Jones's commentary on Romans 3 and 4. It's a bit of an unusual book to give to a non-Christian, but I had read it. didn't understand what was going on really, but understood the logic. And then that night, I went to bed, 3 o'clock in the morning, at least that's when I woke, but while I was asleep, God showed up, and I had a dream. And it was a conversion dream, very dramatic, and in this dream, I'm standing, and I can remember it as if it were now, standing before a sense of awesome presence, although saw no physical body. And I'm asking the question, how? And I take that and took that to mean, how can I know you? How can I become a Christian? And what happened next was a kind of movie. And the movie was of a child, a baby being born, didn't see any real detail. And then the movie moved very fast into a grown-up child, into a man. And then suddenly and very dramatically, the screen went completely and blindingly white so that I reared back in my dream. And then it went completely crimson, as if somebody had thrown a pot of paint at it, of crimson red. And I understood the gospel and woke up a believer. That's my conversion. I woke Marianne up and said, Marianne, I've become a Christian. And she said, go back to sleep, let's talk about it in the morning. Now, I understand that, but you know, as conversions go, that's pretty dramatic. And I understand that God was so gracious because I was such an obstinate character that it took God showing up in a dream, having providentially exposed me to the truth of the gospel, well explained by Dr. Martin Lloyd-Jones, and put that together in a way that I could not but bow the knee to him. And of course, he gave me a new heart to believe. And now, of course, that was the beginning of the story of me as a Christian. We can talk about that afterwards or any time you like. But God has continued to be wonderfully at work in my life as he is in yours. But what the reason I say this is I have no resistance to the reality of the intrusion of the supernatural. That's why I'm telling you this story. It doesn't get more sense of supernatural than that, does it? Go away, Kingsley, then God shows up, and then I'm a Christian. So, that's my personal testimony. So, I have no bias towards being a cessationist, and I am not a cessationist, but let me move on. So, I want to focus then on the natural this evening. Is the desire, that's my posing question, for the spectacular signs and wonders fueled by a wrong or low view of what we call the natural, or what is termed the natural. Now, is our view then of the natural, which actually if you look the word up in the original, in biblical language, natural is a translation of the word physical. It's the physical world, which is the world we encounter as human beings in flesh and stone, rock and metal, right? And gases. So it's the physical world. So is our view of the natural world biblical or worldly? On a daily basis, do we encounter the world around us and our experience through the lens of God's word? Do we really? Now, we know the language. We know how to explain that to somebody. But on a daily basis, in the now, in the workplace, at the kitchen sink, when we're running, when we're playing with our grandchild, do we encounter the world around us and our experiences through the lens of God's word? Do we really, in the now, have, and I hope you can understand this term, if you've ever read the book of Job, you've thrashed your way through the first 37 chapters, and then you get to chapter 38 when God shows up, that's the end, that's the beginning of the end of the book of Job, do we have an end of the book of Job view of the natural? Because it's pretty gobsmacking when God shows up to Job and shows him what Job doesn't see or seem to see. Or rather, do we consign what we see around us to the ordinary and hanker after the extraordinary? I think it's a rare thing these days to hear Christians, at least regularly, speak about the extraordinariness of the natural world. And I don't mean the natural world just about, wow, aren't the animals beautiful and intricate and isn't the way the heart works amazing? Of course, that's true. But just in the whole area of God's providential dealings with his world. But this was not a problem for the psalmists or the Apostle Paul. Let's just remind ourselves of some of those passages, and maybe I'll comment on a couple of things. So here's a very familiar passage quoting from Paul's letter to the Colossians. For by him, the eternal Son of God he's talking about, all things were created, all things, things in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or powers or rules or rulers or authorities, all things were created by him and for him. He is before all things, and in him all things hold together. That's an amazing thing to say. In him, just think about the last few words, why I've underlined them. In him all things hold together. What is the secret of the sustaining of this vast universe? What is it? How are all these molecules and how are all these planets and suns and names of bodies which I don't understand, which are so big and so far away that they make our part of the universe look so tiny? This vast universe, in him, that is in the eternal Son of God, it's all held together, whether an atom or a star. Get your head around that. Contemplate that for a minute. That's the intrusion of the supernatural into our natural world every moment of every day for all of time since God called time into being. In him, all things hold together. Just think about that. So when we see a program on the universe, and there are plenty of them, sadly, they never account for God in them, we can. And we get insights which enable us to see the bigness of this. And then Acts 17. Here is Paul. He's in Athens, and he's found all sorts of idols and all sorts of representations of the gods of in the pantheon of Athens. And he comes across one just in case they've forgotten somebody. This is the unknown god. What would I call it? Temple? Shrine, thank you. Shrine to an unknown god, yeah. And Paul uses that to begin a discourse. And this is what he says. And God made the world and everything in it. The God that who made the world and everything in it is the Lord of heavens and earth and does not live in temples built by hands. He is not served by human hands as if he needed anything. Because he himself gives all men life and breath and everything else. And then we'll skip. And he determined the times set for them and the exact places where they should live. God did this so that men would seek him and perhaps reach out for him and find him, though he is not far from each one of us. This is the supreme supernatural being, the eternal God, for in him we live, move, and have our being. Now, again, why do we sit here and have life this evening? Why do we continue with our life? In him we live, move, and have our being. So every moment we are sustained by God. And as soon as God chooses not to sustain us, that is the end of our life. And we had a tremendously poignant reminder of that this morning, didn't we? With Albert, you know, he's sitting here. I know him very well. He's got a heart condition. I'm thankful he's here. And he's here because God, in his providence, brought him here. So he determines the time set for them in the exact places where they should live. God's in charge of everything. So where was Albert this morning? He was here listening to a very significant sermon. And we've been talking to Albert for a long while. And Albert is in his 70s. And Albert needs to know God. And he knows this. And he's here this morning, thankfully. And then there's this incident. And I don't know about you, but certainly what I was doing was praying, Lord, spare him. He needs to hear the truth. He needs to come to Jesus. Please have mercy on him. And God did. So in that, God acted in the now wonderfully. And we, you know, I was sitting 15 feet from Albert. It was very uncomfortable for him, but it was also uncomfortable for all of us, wasn't it? But God graciously intervenes. And he's not far from any one of us. So pray for Albert. But let's remember that every single human being is every moment of every day dependent on God to sustain them, whether they know it or not, whether they acknowledge God or not. And here's a psalmist that looks at the universe and he sees that there's something beneficial that God tells him through the universe. And that's something about his bigness. When I consider your heavens, the work of your fingers, so no doubt about to him about who is the author of the universe, the moon, the stars, which you've set in place, what is man that you are mindful of him? So he makes this parallel. So it's a ministry to him. So the universe around him, such as he could see it then, actually ministers to his soul. And it reminds him that this big, infinite God that's bigger than the universe because he made it and sustains it, he knows me and he cares about me. So when we're walking around feeling pretty miserable about life, wondering where God is, wondering if God cares, you know what? We've got this great big universe around us. Stars, moon, sun. Even on a fairly rainy day, you know, you can see the sun. Or at least you can feel something of it. And there aren't too many days apart from December and January in the south of England when we don't see these things. But my point is this, that God graciously... And one of the questions I put on the sheet for later is, and you think about it later, you think about it now, but think about it a bit later together, why did God make the universe? Good question to ask yourself. Well, here we are. One of the reasons is in front of us. So that we might know how wonderful his stooping care of us is, despite his greatness. Ephesians. Again, a very wonderful first chapter, isn't it? Just a bit of it in verse 11. In him we were also chosen, talking to Christians now, having been predestined according to the plan of him who works out everything in conformity with the purpose of his will. Now, you can't dodge the comprehensiveness of this language, can you? He works out everything in conformity with the purpose of his will. God is not distant to the world he has made. God is not distant to the creation that he's brought about. He works out everything. He's in the detail. He's in every detail, working it out for his purpose and will. There's only one plan, actually, for this universe. There's only one plan, and that's God's plan. Did you know that? It's the only sure plan, because it's God's plan, and he works out everything to bring about that plan. Nothing can stop it. No one can stop it. No power in the universe can stop it. God irresistibly is working out his plan in every detail. And we'll think about that in a couple of minutes. And then this wonderful psalm here, one of my kind of short list of psalms that I go back to when I'm getting the overjoyfuls. The Lord will fulfill his purpose for me. Your love, O Lord, endures forever. And this amazing call to God. Do not abandon the works of your hands. We're the works of his hands. The God who created the universe, we're the works of his hands. And it's happening. What does Paul say in Philippians? Work out, I haven't got it here, but work out your own salvation in fear and trembling. Now that is a pretty demanding thing to do. We work it out. Knowing this, because it's God's plan, you see, to bring all his children to glory. Work out your own salvation in fear and trembling. Knowing this, it is God who works in you, both to will and do his good pleasure. So he causes us to desire to do it, and then to do it by the work of the Holy Spirit. So God is at work in us, because he will fulfill his purpose for me. Here's a quote which I found in my work in preparation for tonight. It's from John Woodhouse. He was the principal, or maybe he's still the principal, of Moore College in Sydney. And he wrote the very helpful paper entitled, Where Have All the Miracles Gone? Which I found very helpful in my prep. And he concludes it with these words, which kind of was scratching where I was going, although I didn't discover these words until much later in my studies. It is not as though some events in this world are more an act of God than others. Much that God does is what he usually does. We misleadingly call these things natural. Sometimes God acts contrary to his usual ways. These things, of course, surprise us and amaze us. And it's wonderful that they amaze us, but they're both done by God. But we really should be amazed constantly at the one who is, at every moment, holding the whole creation together. Now, if we got that right, we wouldn't, I don't think, be subject to being drawn aside by an overemphasis on a desire for the miraculous. But that's something you can discuss in your groups. More than 300 years before John Woodhouse, and I'm having to go on. Graham, you should have reminded me to motor on because I'm taking too much time. Yeah. Before John Woodhouse penned these insightful and challenging words, well, John Flavel, one of the later Puritans, wrote a great and helpful book. It's a bit flowery, like many of the Puritan books, but it is full of nuggets of gold. The mystery of providence. And here are just two of the chapter headings I've picked out. So our birth and our upbringing. So what he does is he applies those words from Acts 17:26. He determined the times set for them and the exact places where they should live. In the context of why did you end up in this part of England or wherever you were converted and not in some other place, in a Muslim land or in a Hindu land or in a communist land? Why did you land up in here? And how did it all work out, that journey, so that one night you go to bed and God would show up and show you what the truth was of Jesus? Well, that's our birth and our upbringing. In the work of conversion, I've kind of folded those two together. But meditating on the complexity of times and places and people as God's unseen but sovereign hand is at work that used to bring us just to that right place where we heard the gospel and responded to it because God was sovereignly at work. God, the supernatural God, is at work in our physical world to bring all kinds of wonderful things about as he works out his plan. And in reflecting on Psalm 138, which I already quoted, This is what Flavel says. It is the duty of the saints, especially in times of straits, which he means by that is times of testing, difficult times, to reflect upon the performances, this is a wonderfully flowery, isn't it? Performance of providence, in other words, God's work for them in all states and through all stages of their lives. And I think I'll just very much summarize the next one and then we'll conclude. There we go. But I want to come back to the scriptures long before this, long before Flavel. A mature Abraham who at last received that long-awaited and promised son is faced with just such straits. With the words that on the face of it, if we're just reading it for the first time, I think we'd agree with this. When you read the words that follow, here is a rejoicing Abraham with his son. And then he hears these words. And they border, don't they, on the absurd. Take your son, the one you've long waited for, the one in whom all the future of redemption is tied up. Take your son, your only son Isaac, whom you love, just to make the point, and go to the region of Moriah, sacrifice him there to me as a burnt offering on one of the mountains I will tell you about. And that's shocking. How do we then account for Abraham's questioning and obedient response? And the book of Hebrews tells us. Abraham reasoned, it says in Hebrews 11:19, God could raise the dead. And why did he reason that? Well, in working it through, he is saying to himself as he journeys, surely, that God is a God who keeps his promises. So if God is a God who keeps his promises, how can the promise be true? And how can I sacrifice my son? If I'm going to bring those two things together, you know what? There's only one thing that can happen. God is going to raise him from the dead. And of course, there's a tremendous picture of Jesus and the Father's sacrifice of his son. But he doesn't, does he? But actually, Abraham sets out and he has reasoned. He doesn't go thinking, oh my word, how am I going to cope with this? He just goes. But he says to his servants, by the time he's traveled 3 days, we will worship and then we will come back to you. Because he knows that God is true to his promises. Now, that's meditating on the promises of God through the lens of his word to us. So faith is being sure of what we hope for and certain of what we do not see. And that's Hebrews, that's the beginning of that great chapter 11 of Hebrews. And what I want to finish with is just by saying this. We, I think, surely need to rediscover what I've called the God-honoring and faith-building discipline of meditating, part of which is reasoning through our circumstances through the lens of God's all-sufficient word in all our circumstances, particularly those of difficult times. Now, we don't have time for it, but afterwards, if you want to talk to me about how this passage in particular have helped Marion and I through some really difficult straits, then talk to me. But this has been very real to us. We're very thankful for it. But we need to develop that discipline. And I want to get you doing that by looking at some of the questions I put together.